This is Pastor Emery with broadcast number 5 on The Money Changers. I have two newspaper articles in front of me. One tells me that interest rates have gone so high that home building is off 30% and that only one working family out of five can now afford to purchase a home. The second newspaper article tells me that banks in 1980 increased their earnings from 15% to as much as 60% above 1979, and they did it because of the increase in interest rates. The bankers tell us high interest rates are for the people's good, but the profits from those interest rates go into their pockets, not the pockets of the American people. Is someone lying to us? Last week we saw that Jesus Christ condemned usury on money. God willing, we'll continue today with our study of the United States banking and money system to see if it relates at all to the actions and words of Jesus Christ when he drove the money changers out of the temple 1,900 years ago and told them they had made his house a den of thieves. Stay tuned. Thank you. I do hope most of you heard last week's broadcast on the parable of Luke 19. This is where Jesus told the unfaithful servant, "Wherefore then gavest thou not my money into the bank, that at my coming I might have required mine own with usury?" That verse has been used for over 50 years by the modernist clergy to teach that Jesus Christ approved of usury on money in spite of the law of God prohibiting it. However, as we saw last week, it teaches the exact opposite. For the servant first told his master that he thought the master was a cruel man and a thief. And only then did Jesus answer, "Well, if you thought I was a cruel man and a thief, then why did you not collect usury on my money?" In effect, Jesus was saying, if you think Jesus is a cruel master and a thief, then you should steal for him by charging usury. Jesus equated usury on money with theft, just as the Mosaic Law does, as so do the prophets, and as American churches taught, many of them, even up to 50 years ago. Today, God willing, I am going to teach you or remind you of some of our history showing how our disobedience to God's economic laws on usury, on debt, on theft, and so on, has resulted in our people rapidly becoming tenants in the land their forefathers conquered. The bankers and the other financial multi-billionaires are taking legal possession of or collecting usury on practically every square foot of land on this continent. On every new $60,000 home in the United States, the moneylenders will not furnish a board, a piece of glass, a shingle, a nail, a blister, or a drop of sweat, and yet they will collect upwards of $200,000 in usury from that one $60,000 home before that home is 30 years old. No work, no sweat, no worthwhile contribution to society, yet the wealth of the nation is passing into their hands. In spite of that, we are constantly being told America's financial system is the best in the world, and we are even told that the bankers and the Federal Reserve chairman who set interest rates are doing it all for the good of the American people. We are told by these economic prognosticators, in effect, the bankers are going to do something good for you. You stay tuned, and perhaps we'll see why Jesus Christ, who resorted to violence only one time in all of his earthly ministry, directed that violence at the money changers. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul recounted some Israelite history and then told his readers, "All these things happen unto them for examples and are written for our admonition," or for our learning, "for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come." The word translated "world" in that passage should have read "age." Paul is saying Israel's history was written down so you people who live in the end of this age can learn from it. A noted historian once wrote, "Men who will not learn from history are bound to repeat it." So like Paul, I am going to remind you of some of our own past history that has to do with money and economics. I am doing that for the same reason Paul reminded the early Christians of Israel's past history, that they might learn from it. In past broadcasts, I've shown you that the charging of interest on money is a sin. It is a transgression of God's law. And I read to you Deuteronomy 28, verses 43 and 44, which I think I shall read to you again before we turn to our history. Deuteronomy 28 is a listing by God Almighty of the blessings which would come for obedience to His laws, followed by a listing of the curses which would come upon the people if they disobeyed those same laws. Among other things, God said that if they disobeyed, this would happen. Verse 43 and 44 of Deuteronomy 28. The stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail. The next verse repeats why this all would happen. Moreover, all these curses shall come upon thee, and shall pursue thee, and overtake thee, till thou be destroyed, because thou hearkenest not unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to keep his commandments and his statutes which he commanded thee. Then, in case you have been taught that this all ended 1,500 years later, at the time of Christ, here's verse 46. And they, meaning the curses, and they shall be upon thee for a sign and for a wonder, and upon thy seed forever. These things, these curses, are automatic. That is the law. That is God's law, that his people, disobeying his commandments, would come under debt bondage in their land. They would become the servants of those who lend them money. Now, back to history, part of which I am going to read from a book of my own, which I wrote about 10 years ago, and which is now out of print. Sorry, no copies available, but you listen and see if this does not fit that which you know to be true and that which you know has happened in our recent history. The first is a statement as to the absolute necessity of money for our society, and then it goes on about history. Quote, civilization as we know it could not exist without an adequate and even an abundant supply of money. Modern society could forego many other rather important things, but without an adequate supply of money, our industries would slow down, our farms would recede to become self-sustaining family units, surplus food would disappear, many jobs requiring the work of more than a few men would go undone, and the purchase and transportation of large volumes of goods would cease. Within a short time, unemployment would lead to starvation, and mobs of hungry people would plunder and kill in order to remain alive. Civilization would return to the Dark Ages, and all government except family or very small groups would cease to function. An overstatement? Not at all. Money is the means of all commercial trade except simple barter. It is the measure and the instrument by which one product is sold and another purchased. If we were to abolish money, or even to reduce it below the amount necessary to sustain current trade, the results would be catastrophic. For an example of such an event, we need only look back to the Depression of the early 1930s in America. During the Depression years of 1928 to 1939, our country did not lack industrial capacity, fertile farmland, skilled and willing workers, or industrious farm families. We had the most extensive and efficient transportation system in the entire world. In the previous 100 years, we had outstripped all other nations in railroads, road networks, and water transportation. Our communication systems between regions and localities were the best in the world, utilizing telephone, teletype, radio, and a well-operated government mail system. No war had ravaged our cities or countryside for more than 60 years since the Civil War, which in any case was largely confined to the South. No pestilence had weakened our population, nor had famine ravaged the land. The United States of America in the 1930s lacked only one thing, an adequate supply of money to carry on trade and commerce. How had this happened? Quite simply, bankers, the source of America's money and credit, had deliberately withheld $8 billion from circulation by refusing additional loans to stable and growing industries, stores, and farmers. At the same time, they demanded payment on existing loans so that money was rapidly taken out of circulation and was not replaced. The almost immediate shortage of money which followed brought on the Great Depression, and America was in trouble. Goods were plentiful and available to be purchased. Jobs were waiting to be done, but there was little money available. 25% of the workers were laid off their jobs in less than 2 years. Bankers, who had deliberately caused this depression, then foreclosed on tens of thousands of farms and businesses. Gloom settled over America, and the people blamed everybody but the real culprits for their trouble, just as they do today. The Great Depression lasted until 1938 or 1939, with unemployment remaining above 20% until 1939. Then the United States government began borrowing and spending large amounts of money, putting it into circulation for military preparedness for ourselves and for our future allies in Europe. Just as soon as the money supply became available, our people were hired back to work, farmers sold their produce instead of plowing it under, mines reopened, factories began to hum, industrial and residential construction began anew, and the Great Depression was over. Some politicians were blamed for it, and others took credit for ending it. The truth is that lack of money caused it, and adequate supplies of money ended it. The American people were never told this simple truth, and the control of our money remained in the hands of the millionaire bankers. When we see the disastrous results of an artificially created shortage of money, we can better understand why our Christian founding fathers placed the power to create money and the power to control it only in the hands of the federal Congress. If all citizens, instead of a few, are to share in the profits of this creation, the national government is the only legal body which should have that power of creation. Furthermore, if all citizens of whatever state or station in life are to benefit from an adequate and stable currency, the national government must be, by law, the only controller of the value of our money. Since the federal Congress is the only legislative body subject to all the citizens at the ballot box, our founding fathers saw it as the only safe depository of so much power. So they wrote into the Constitution of the United States of America the simple, unequivocal, but inclusive, Congress shall have power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. That is in Article 1 and Section 8. Instead of the constitutional method of creating our money and putting it into circulation, we now have an illegal and entirely unconstitutional system. This has resulted in the present almost disastrous debts, war, and crime, as we shall see. Since our money was handled both legally and illegally before 1913, we shall discuss the situation only since 1913, when all of our money, creation, and control passed into the hands of the bankers. Prior to 1913, America was a prosperous, powerful, and growing nation, at peace with her neighbors and the envy of the world. Only minor military wars, in which we were fantastically successful, had marred the peace since the end of the Civil War. Inventions and buildings seemed to herald a new day of peace and plenty, not only for America, but for the entire world if it were to follow our example. And then, in December of 1913, while most of its members were away for the Christmas holidays, Congress passed what has since been known as the Federal Reserve Act. This law was introduced and passed with all the fanfare and propaganda to the effect that this would remove money from politics. They did not say, and therefore from the people's control. The propaganda said, It would prevent inflation and depressions and would promote progress and prosperity. Omitting the burdensome details, this Federal Reserve law simply authorized the establishment of a Federal Reserve Corporation with a board of directors, the Federal Reserve Board, to run it, and the United States was divided into 12 Federal Reserve districts. This simple but despicable law completely removed from the Congress the right to create money or to have any control over its creation and gave that function to the privately owned Federal Reserve Corporation. The people were not told, and most of them still do not know today, that the Federal Reserve Corporation is a privately owned corporation and as such is operated for the financial enrichment of its owners instead of for the welfare and for the best interests of the citizens of the United States of America. The word federal is just another part of its colossal deception. Since that day of infamy in 1913, more disastrous to America than was Pearl Harbor, a small number of people, probably less than 500,000, have accrued to themselves all of the profits of printing our money and more. Remember, as we learned before, it cost them only about 0.7 cents to print a dollar bill, a $10 bill, a $100 bill, or a $1,000 bill. Since 1913, they have created tens of billions of dollars in money and credit, which, as their own personal property, they then lend to our government and to our people at interest. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer has become the secret policy of our federal government and the Federal Reserve System. An examination of the banker's process of creation and its conversion to debt to the people will aid our understanding. Here is how it is done. For the sake of illustration, let us say that the federal government needs $1 billion more than it has received from taxes and other revenue in order to meet its expenses. Since it does not have the money, and Congress has given away its authority to create new money, the government must go to the bankers for the $1 billion. The Federal Reserve, however, a private corporation and one which is not established for philanthropic purposes, does not just give its money away for nothing. Instead, the bankers lend $1 billion in money or credit to the U.S. government in exchange for the government's agreement to pay it back plus interest. So our Congress then orders the Treasury Department to print $1 billion in United States bonds, which they then deliver to the Federal Reserve bankers. The Federal Reserve bankers are charged with the cost of printing, perhaps a few thousand dollars, and the exchange is complete. What is the outcome of this fantastic transaction? Simply this. The U.S. government thus obtains the $1 billion to pay its obligation. However, the government now has indebted the people to the bankers for $1 billion and has agreed to pay interest on this amount to the bankers. 1 year's interest on this loan would amount to more than $60 million, which would continue year after year. The only cost to the bankers for originating this loan would be less than $2,000. The first year's profit would be $60 million. Since this and hundreds of similar criminal transactions have taken place since 1913, now, a little more than 60 years later, the people of this nation are indebted to the banking families to the tune of $700 billion, on which we pay these banking families over $2 billions, not millions, $2 billions every month for interest, with no hope of ever paying off the principal unless we default and give them title to the entire United States of America. In 1910, the U.S. national debt was $12.40 per citizen. By 1920, after only 6 years of Federal Reserve shenanigans, the national debt had jumped to $24 billion, or $228 per person. By 1968, the national debt reached $350 billion, or $1,700 per citizen. By the time of this broadcast, that amount is over $700 billion and over $4,000 per person. Putting that in the context of working families since after all, the families who do not work, who do not pay taxes, and who are on welfare do not owe any of the debt per se, that would be a national debt of approximately $50,000 for every working family in America. That figure, of course, does not include state debt, municipal debt, school district, or personal debts, which total an additional $5 trillion by the 1980s. And bear this in mind. The moneylenders acquired all of this for the mere cost of paper, ink, and bookkeeping. God Almighty is truly righteous when He calls usury an abomination. This is Pastor Sheldon Emery, and my time is up again. God willing, we will continue this study on the money changers next week. Until next week, when I return, God willing, with broadcast number 6 on the money changers, this is Pastor Emery saying goodbye. God bless you. Read your Bibles and pray for Christian America.